Blog Talk Radio.
Giggity, giggity. What's up, everybody? I think we have another big day today. Though I can't be quite sure. There's a Dem debate tonight, if I'm not mistaken. Okay, it's getting so scattered over here that I can't even keep up with all the shit I'm supposed to keep up with. There is a Dem debate tonight, am I right? And I think it starts at 9 o'clock. It's PBS and CNN. So naturally, I will be live tweeting that. Hopefully, I'll be able to upload everything before then, but doubtful. But either way, I'll be live tweeting because I apparently can't pull myself away from a TV set when the debates are going on. So we'll talk about that. And, well, actually, not today. Tomorrow, I'll give you the full breakdown like I always do, but we got a lot of great stuff before then. We have John Kasich showing his true colors here. Now, he is technically a moderate in this Republican Party, but that doesn't really mean much. It's like being the tallest kid in kindergarten because he ain't really that moderate, and I'll prove it to you here in the opening story. And then as we move along here, we got our buddy David Pakman talking to Trump supporters, or a Trump supporter, and picking his brain a little bit and figuring out exactly why it is this person is voting for Trump. And it's all the stuff that I've been telling you about for weeks now, if not months. And the guy almost goes down the checklist of all the things that I've been telling you about. So we'll break that down for you as well. Bill O'Reilly goes after Bernie Sanders because he wants him to talk about black-on-black crime. Oh, goodness. And then later on in the show, we have a hideous, hideous terror attack that happened in Nigeria. We got hospitals being bombed left and right in Yemen, and I got to give you some more numbers on that. And President Obama, should he speak to an atheist group? So he's gotten a formal invite from a very well-known atheist group. Should he show a little bit of support for secular America? We'll talk about that a little later on in the show. So let's go ahead and get started here, and we'll kick it off with this John Kasich thing like I was talking about before, and you'll see his true colors. So John Kasich just finished second in the New Hampshire primary, which kind of revived his presidential campaign a little bit. Now, don't get me wrong, moving forward, he's still down in many of the polls in the upcoming states. So he's got a long way to go. But the fact that he finished second means that with Rubio falling off a cliff and Jeb never getting any momentum, it means that he is kind of like the establishment fallback guy right now, which sucks for the establishment, but he doesn't have that great of a chance, but he's hanging in there. So recently, a lot of people have been talking about how this is a moderate. And it's true. This is a moderate Republican in today's Republican Party. Chris Hayes tweeted about Kasich the other night, and he said something along the lines of, this is compassionate conservatism 2.0. For those of you who don't know, compassionate conservatism is actually a reference to the platform George W. Bush ran on in 2000. A lot of people don't know this. He didn't campaign as a crazy neocon who's going to do all these wars and, you know, cut taxes for the rich and that do all these far-right ideas. He actually campaigned as a compassionate conservative who cared about people and who was going to allow the government to help our own people. He even went as far as to say at times that we're not going to nation build. That's not true. They obviously went on to do that, and they were clearly neoconservatives. But the idea of compassionate conservatism seemed dead. And then here comes Kasich, and Kasich being much more reasonable and moderate than all the other candidates, dares to say stuff like, maybe we should do rehab and treatment for people that have drug addictions. And you can go down the list on a variety of issues. He seems to be more reasonable. And but another thing he talks about, for example, is just balancing the budget. This is kind of like an old school Republican idea before they went 100% nuts. And he's certainly staked that position. He is the moderate in this party. But let's not forget, he's still a governor. He's the governor of Ohio. And him being a moderate doesn't mean that much in the current context of the Republican Party. So Raw Story reports here, quote, "A bill that would defund Planned Parenthood clinics in Ohio was approved by lawmakers and sent to Governor John Kasich's desk for approval on Wednesday. State Republicans developed House Bill 294 in the wake of the heavily edited anti-abortion sting videos, which were quickly debunked. So what does Mr. Moderate over here himself plan on doing? Quote, "I'm going to sign a bill to defund it, so you shouldn't be confused." Huh. Now, to be fair to him, he does go on and say, "I do want funding for domestic abuse victims, for example, and I'm fine with family planning and stuff like that, but abortion is the problem, and I would sign a bill that defunds Planned Parenthood if it's sent to my desk. And lest you think this is just about abortion, no, there's already no funding for abortion, and the way that it's the bill is worded, it defunds all of the 27 Planned Parenthoods in Ohio, and only three of them even provide abortions, by the way, but it defunds all 27 because they say, even if it's a place that just gives out information on abortion, defund it." So here's your Republican moderate. There were also stories that broke, I believe, yesterday or the day before about how Kasich has been gutting food stamps and the social safety net for people in his state as well. So even when you talk about a moderate Republican in the context of this current Republican Party, still a pretty far right-wing guy. And John Kasich is just another example of somebody who has shifted with the Overton window, shifted with the spectrum to the right, to the point where, don't get me wrong, it is fair to call him a moderate because he's much more moderate than, a guy like Ted Cruz or Rick Santorum or Donald Trump or the rest of them. But that doesn't mean he's a good guy. That doesn't mean that his policies make sense. It means that on his report card, instead of getting an F, he gets a D minus. Now, I want to go ahead and jump right into this Trump thing because, man, we can have a long discussion on this one, and we probably should, to really dive into every aspect of it. David Pakman from the David Pakman Show spoke to a Trump supporter recently, and there's quite a bit to learn from this back and forth. So let's watch, and then I'll break it down.
As an independent, which primary you want to vote in? How did you decide anyway?
Because I'm sick of the same. What's going on? Both candidates, Bernie and Trump, opened up a sleeping giant here in the country, and we had it with the establishment. We need people that's going to work for us, that care about us. And right now, that's why, politics today, especially today's, look around you, it's amazing what's going on here today.
But how did that get you to the Republican primary today?
How did it get me today?
Yeah, in other words, as an independent, you could have voted in the Democratic or the Republican.
I understand. That was the guy. I'm just sick of the same stuff.
Trump is the guy, you're saying?
Empty promises. Empty promises.
And Donald, so you voted for Trump today?
I vote for Trump because a lot of people don't have to like him, but you have to respect what he's doing. He's paying for his own campaign. I heard he only spent like less than $3 million. And
Trump change, right?
Yeah, to him, yeah. But he's a media genius, so he knows how to capitalize. And that's smart thinking. So use that, and if he's going to use that to run in the country, that's very important, too, as well. I mean,
okay.
I got invited to see Rubio today, and because I know a gentleman here who's sponsoring him. And I went in, no, I didn't vote for him, but he's a good guy. He's a future. His time is not now. He's a good guy. I respect the guy, but his time is not now. He's the future of the Republicans. If he doesn't do it this term, he might do it the next.
Well, let's dig in. Broken promises, you said.
Yeah.
What promises specifically upset you?
Just like what, national health care. we should have, like, some form of national health, even though I do have a health insurance.
But who promised national health care?
Originally, I think it was Bill Clinton initially, way back in the day. I remember him saying that when I was younger. I remember him saying that.
And that got you today to vote for Donald Trump.
I mean, Obamacare is an absolute farce. There's people that don't want to pay it because they, you know, because they can't afford it. And we should have a national health care system like England and Canada. We should. We're very.
Do you know which candidate supports that?
Bernie Sanders, I believe.
But you didn't vote for Bernie.
I didn't. But Trump said it. He would do it too, but he never came out with an initial plan. Bernie didn't either. But the fact that they're mentioning it, you know.
Bernie did say he supports Medicare for all. He's put forward a plan for that. Other than health care, what issue got you voting for Trump today?
I think we need leadership in this country. Someone who stands up for strength is very important.
That's so telling. David Pakman did a great job there, credit to him, because he really got this guy to lay it out there and give a variety of reasons as to why he's doing what he's doing. And it's pretty much what we've been saying all along as to what we think the motivation is for Trump voters. Now, we did a story a while ago about how there's some sort of technology that allows you to calculate what grade level the different politicians are speaking at. And Trump came out at, I think it was like a fourth grade level, one of the lowest of everybody running. And everybody across the board, all the pundits were mocking it and laughing at it for good reason. I mean, it shows that he's not speaking at a high level. But I was one of very few people who said, this might actually be a net positive. I don't think you guys understand. When you try to boil everything down to its tiniest, most pure form, and you can speak in quick, punchy sentences, it has this ability to just click with your average person. And they get it. They can, if you're emoting something, they feel it. They go, okay, yeah, I got it. I'm connecting with that guy because of how he's talking. So that leads to one of the main things that this guy said, which was at the end here, where he said, it's strength, leadership. Leadership, strength. Well, that's Trump branding 101. He makes you think he's something because he just repeats it over and over and over and over until you go, okay, I understand you're that. Even if you're not that, I'm going to say you're that because you kept saying it. We got to win. We got to win. We got to win. That's what we got to do. We got to win. It's tremendous. I'm going to make this country tremendous. I'm going to make it great. We got to win. So the guy's like, leadership, you know, strength. Trump oozes confidence, and confidence is something that not many political strategists point to as a key factor for success, but it is a key factor for success. That's a much bigger plus than, you know, somebody like Marco Rubio or somebody like Martin O'Malley, who's a standard sleazy politician, and they talk in that rhythm and that cadence, and they have the inflection over the right words and the right emphasis. That's old school, man. That doesn't go over anymore. People like strength. And when Trump portrays himself like that, people go, yes, I like that guy. I'm connecting with that guy. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, if you notice, I've said it before, Trump says everything at the same time. And then what happens? Your run-of-the-mill Republican voter will just project onto Trump whatever they want him to believe and say. So Trump has said at times, yeah, let's do a national health care system. He said, we're not going to let people die in the street. We're going to cover everybody. The government's going to do it. He said these things even during the campaign. Well, the national health care system specifically, he said back in the day. But he's made comments that explain what a national health care system is, and he's advocated for that during the campaign. But then other times he'll advocate for the exact opposite, which is we need more capitalism, more free enterprise. We need more competition. We need to repeal Obamacare. We need to let people buy insurance over state lines. All the typical right-wing nonsense bullshit solutions. So he's saying both things at the same time. And what does this guy say here? Yeah, I like national health care, so I voted for Trump. Well, the person who's really consistent on that is Bernie Sanders. You know he believes in a single-payer system. Donald Trump says half the time he says that, half the time he says the exact opposite. So what's he doing? This guy's just projecting onto Trump what he wants him to believe. I told you contradictions don't matter that much for right-wing voters. To them, they just, hey, which thing did I like more? If I like this guy talking, he's a right-wing politician, I will just pretend like the thing he believes is the half that he said that agrees with me. So you talk to another Trump voter, and another Trump voter will come out and tell you, yeah, I like him because he's going to get rid of Obamacare and not do national health care. And he does this with every issue on foreign policy. Yeah, let Vladimir Putin fight ISIS. you know, he might as well do the dirty work. Forget it for us. We're done in there. And then in the next sentence or the next appearance, he'll be out there saying, not only should we bomb ISIS and stay there, we should bomb the families of ISIS. Which is it, non-intervention or intervention? Non-intervention or intervention? He says everything. And this is something that's a plus on the Republican side. And then the third thing, and the most important thing, I think, is you heard him. He said, look, man, I'm tired of the establishment. We're getting hosed. And he even gives credit to Bernie. He's like, Bernie, you get the sense he's anti-establishment. Trump, I think he's anti-establishment too. Now, I mean, the reality is that a guy like Bernie actually is anti-establishment, and he does want to make America more like a social democracy like Denmark, which is something I happen to like. Trump is just playing a role. Trump, we covered the article on the show. I think it was the Washington Post that reported on it. Trump went to the same billionaires that all the other Republican candidates go to get their funding and asked them for money at the beginning of the race. They said no. After they said no, then he went out there and said, yeah, I'm self-funding. Look at these guys. They're puppets of the donors, and I'm going to fix this system. I'm going to blow it up. But wait, you were asking for their money before, and you were going to partake in the system. Now that you're not partaking in the system, now you're mad, and now you want to blow the system up. So he's playing a game here, man. He's not really anti-establishment. But just the fact that he portrays himself as anti-establishment, that's sticking in people's minds. How he keeps talking about the donors and the special interests and money controls the politicians and that's how it works. They pull the strings. People go, oh, yeah, I like this guy. He's telling me how the system works and he's going to fix that system. Even though he's probably not going to fix that system, people go, yeah, he's anti-establishment. I'm with him. So that goes to show you, man, people are tired of the old school way of doing things. And it's no surprise. Congress, for example, has a 15% approval rating, and it stays roughly there. We covered a story last year, it was down to 9%. I mean, of course people don't like what's happening because they know that their government is not representing them. They might not be able to tell you the details and the ins and outs of exactly how this system has come about, but they know that, hey, it seems to me like ExxonMobil and Wall Street and big business, these guys get what they want. We never get what we want. And in fact, that's bared out in the political science research, the Princeton study, which found that the U.S. is effectively an oligarchy, not a democracy anymore. So people are looking for the ones who are not going to play within the rules and within the system. You know, everybody is so amazed. Oh, my God, Trump said pussy and he went up in the polls. Yeah, but that's a reason why people like him, because he's saying, fuck your bullshit rules. Fuck your nonsense establishment game. I'm not playing that game. And when I get in there, I'm going to represent the people, and I'm not going to represent the special interests. Now, again, for Trump, I don't think that's true, but this is what people are getting from it. So you mix everything here together in this recipe, and then you got people who are saying, yeah, I'm definitely voting for Trump. Trump got more than double the votes of the person who came in second in New Hampshire in the Republican primary. That was John Kasich. He got more than double John Kasich's votes. If you don't think there's something to this yet, you're crazy. Not only is he a real candidate, not only is he viable, it's his race to lose. Think about that. Now, let's go to Bill O'Reilly here. Actually, no, wrong. Let me go to John McCain. This is a really, really important story. John McCain has been watching the same Republican debates that you and I have, and he's appalled. He's really angry because there's one key issue where John McCain has been consistently correct over the years, and this is an issue where many of his fellow Republicans are dead wrong, and he's going to come out here and give a fiery speech because he can't believe that we're really having this national debate about whether or not we should torture again.
That's why it's been so disappointing to see some presidential candidates engaged in loose talk on the campaign trail about reviving waterboarding and other inhumane interrogation techniques. It might be easy to dismiss this bluster as cheap campaign rhetoric, but these statements must not go unanswered because they mislead the American people about the realities of interrogation, how to gather intelligence, what it takes to defend our security, and at the most fundamental level, what we are fighting for as a nation and what kind of nation we are. It's important to remember the facts that these forms of torture not only failed their purpose to secure actionable intelligence to prevent further attacks on the United States and our allies, but compromised our values, stained our national honor, and did little practical good. While some have shamefully sought to minimize the practice of waterboarding, it is clear to me that this practice, which is a simulated execution by drowning, amounts to torture as any reasonable person would define it, and how the Geneva Conventions, of which we are signatories, on the treatment of prisoners of war defines it. The use of these methods by the United States was shameful and unnecessary because the United States has tried, convicted, and executed foreign combatants who employed methods of torture, including waterboarding, against American prisoners of war. Following World War II, Japanese generals were tried and convicted and hung, and one of the charges against them was that they practiced waterboarding. They practiced contrary to assertions made, some of the defenders, it produced little useful intelligence to help us track down the perpetrators of the September 11th attacks or prevent new attacks and atrocities. I know from personal experience that the abuse of prisoners will produce more bad than good intelligence. I know that victims of torture will offer intentionally misleading information if they think their captors will believe it. I know they will say whatever they think their torturers want them to say if they believe it will stop their suffering. Most of all, I know the use of torture compromises that which most distinguishes us from our enemies, our belief that all people, even captured enemies, possess basic human rights which are protected by international conventions the United States not only joined, but for the most part authored. We fight also for an idea that all men are endowed by their Creator with inalienable rights. That's all men and women. How much safer the world would be if all nations believed the same? How much more dangerous it can become when we forget it ourselves, even momentarily, as we learn from Abu Ghraib.
For those of you who don't know, John McCain was actually tortured himself. He was tortured in Vietnam, and that's the reason he can't really raise his hands above, like, shoulder height. So, I mean, he knows this issue inside and out in intimate and gruesome detail. And every time it comes up, he cringes. Because he says it, hey, man, look, I think we're the good guys. So you can't do that, because then you're not the good guy. I mean, it's pretty simple when you boil it down. And McCain, I mean, we've spoken about him a million times, and there are other areas where, in my view, he has total blind spots. I mean, he really is a hawk, and he's in favor of intervening everywhere. Somebody wants to compile a list of all the places John McCain wants to invade, and it's never-ending. So don't get me wrong, he's not right in every respect, but on this one, is he correct? Oh, no question about it. Guys, torture oftentimes leads to false confessions. I mean, this is something I feel like we don't talk about enough. As McCain pointed out, what are you going to say? You're going to say whatever you think the person torturing you wants to hear. That doesn't necessarily mean it's the truth. It means you're going to give them what they want to hear. So oftentimes people will be tortured and they say, yeah, I'm guilty of the crime. I did it. And they didn't do it, but they're just saying it so you stop fucking torturing them because they want the pain to stop. I mean, this is why, you know, stuff like that, it would never be admissible in court. If you get information, yeah, I had fucking pliers hooked up to his nipples and I was twisting really hard. Well, I'm pretty sure that information is not to be trusted. You know, the situation was not set for accuracy there. It seems like you're just trying to get out whatever you want. And we know from 9/11 and Iraq what happened. We tortured to get the answer, oh yeah, Saddam had something to do with it.
And then we went in there, and you know what we did, and you know how that went.
We got that information from torturing somebody and fishing for that answer. The Bush administration wanted that answer. And then we got it, and then we destroyed Iraq, and we did an unnecessary war, and hundreds of thousands of civilians died. So that's what we know torture got us. Here's what it didn't get us. Any useful information that prevented any attacks. This isn't a Senate torture report, guys. They say not a single attack was prevented by this. You want to know why? You don't live in the fucking movie. You don't live in the movies, and you're not, you know, in the show 24. You're not Steven Seagal. You're not Chuck Norris. This is the real world. And what happens when you allow torture is it's not like you allow it and then, oh, gosh golly, we somehow managed to only do it once, and in the one time we did it, it was the ticking time bomb scenario, and we saved a million people. No, when you greenlight torture, overwhelmingly you're going to get the wrong people, and like I just said, there's no evidence we stopped any attack. So we know from what happened in Guantanamo you can't trust the government to always get it right with no oversight and no process set up. This is the whole point of due process. The people who love small government should be the most on the side of course, I don't want the government to torture. Why? You're going to trust the government that every single person that they bring in is an enemy combatant or whatever, and that they torture. Oh, we know that's a bad guy. It's not like we have people in the middle of a firefight shooting, and they capture him, and then they take him away, and then they prevent a terror attack by torturing him. No. What happened is, with Gitmo, as I've explained before, the Bush administration cut a deal with Pakistan and Afghanistan, the governments there, and they just shipped us people who they told us were al-Qaeda. Of course, they weren't al-Qaeda. They were totally innocent. They were just people who were enemies of the state in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And then we tortured them and kept them locked up with no trial, and then we ended up being the criminals. This is why you need due process. This is why you need a constitution to prevent this stuff from happening. Due process is not just there for shits and giggles. It's there to try to adjudicate and figure out whether or not said person is guilty of a certain crime. And finally, let me just say this, man. You are what you do. You are what you do. So if you're a nation that tortures, you're a nation that tortures. Your government tortures. Your actions define who you are. It's not, nobody can gets to say, I'm the good guy no matter what, so now I get to do whatever I want, just declare myself a good guy. No, but what actions have you taken, and then we will evaluate whether or not you're the good guy based on those actions. Because here's the deal. Everybody thinks they're the fucking good guy. I got news for you. In Japan, when it was World War II, when we were fighting them, and as McCain was telling the story there, how they waterboarded our guys, you don't think they thought they were the good guys? Perhaps they were torturing to try to figure out if there was going to be a nuclear bomb dropped on, say, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, where hundreds of thousands of civilians would die immediately. So, of course, everybody thinks they're the good guy. So then, if everybody thinks that and everybody claims that, how do you determine who's really the good guy? Look at the record. And it's the people who uphold their values, even when the times are rough, that are the real good guys. Because they're the ones who have done the right thing with constitutional rights and human rights, and they've said, this one's off the table. We never violate these things, because once you go down that path, there's no turning back. Okay. Let me take a break. When we come back, we got Bill O'Reilly versus Bernie Sanders. Conservative radio host Michael Savage goes nuts, and a ridiculous, horrendous terror attack in Nigeria. Stay right there, guys. We'll be right back. Rich. All right, we're back, guys. And now we go on to Bill O'Reilly and the argument that he's using against Bernie Sanders here. He's at it again. He hit Bernie Sanders about a month ago, but now he's back. Apparently he wants me to respond again. I think that video did get quite a few views where Bill O'Reilly, what did he say again? The economy would collapse under Bernie Sanders. Yeah. He took that from a study, actually, that was conducted in his rectum. Bill O'Reilly is going to go after Bernie Sanders here for talking about mass incarceration without bringing up black-on-black crime.
Now, on the Democrat side, Bernie Sanders must get black votes in order to compete with Hillary Clinton in South Carolina and Nevada. He started his campaign for those votes last night.
When we talk about transforming America, it means ending the disgrace of this country having more people in jail than any other country in the world, disproportionately African American and Latino.
Well, Sanders says he's a straight talker, but not on this issue. Here's the truth. African Americans make up 13% of the total population in the USA, but commit 37% of all murders. And 90% of black murder victims are killed by other blacks. You will never, ever hear either Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton say that. Public candidates will not likely point it out either because it's politically incorrect. It's much easier to cry racism than actually address the root causes of violent crime, which are a corrosive culture and the collapse of the traditional family.
Okay, where to begin here? Bill, that statistic is almost exactly the same for white people. 90% of blacks are killed by other blacks! Got them! Why don't those blacks stop committing crimes, goddammit? Like I said, it's about the same for white people. Now, why is that? Because it just so happens to be the case that black people mostly live around other black people, and white people mostly live around other white people. And you end up killing people who you're around, if you kill people. That's usually how it works. So the reason why people don't bring up that point often, Bill, is because it's an asinine point to make. And it's clear that you're working backwards to your conclusion. Your conclusion being, it's got to be their fault. It's got to always be bootstraps. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Personal responsibility. That's what this comes down to. And he goes on to say it clearly there. He says, we got to get down to the real root causes here, which are a corrosive culture and the destruction of the family. Okay, now, here's the rebuttal to that. In terms of the family, what led to the destruction of the family that you're talking about? He never wants to get into that. He just wants to make it seem like or imply that, well, you know, they just can't keep their shit together, so they end up getting more divorces. They end up having kids out of wedlock, and you can only blame them. That's who else are you going to blame? It's obviously only their fault. Except when you look back historically, there began to be a so-called breakdown of the family when we started shipping out all of the good-paying, middle-class factory jobs that African-Americans were getting. So as soon as we started doing, you know, NAFTA and the WTO and CAFTA and permanent normal trade relations with China, and as soon as we started closing up manufacturing jobs in the U.S., well, then there was, you know, all the black families that were making it to the middle class, all of a sudden they were poor, and then what's one of the main things that leads to divorce? Financial troubles. So this is tied to macroeconomic problems that we have. This idea that it's just like, you know, just how they are. They can't keep their shit together. They should just not get divorced. I mean, think about how silly that is. Think about how poor that logic is. Like, so what do you want to do, Bill? You just, well, let's go knock on doors and force people like, why, hey, you, stay together. Stop having babies out of wedlock. And also, you know what would help that as well? Family planning. Of course, free clinics. Planned Parenthood, contraception, more education, sex education. Are you in favor of that, Bill? No, he's not in favor of that. But hey, stop having kids out of wedlock, the destruction of the American family. Now watch as I ship more of your good jobs overseas and you become poor and I prevent family planning and free clinics.
Okay, so that's addressing just the family part of his argument. Now, to the corrosive culture part of the argument, that's a dodge. It's an out-and-out dodge. Look, Bill, in so-called white culture, we have Rambo, Sylvester Stallone. We have the Terminator, Arnold Schwarzenegger. We have Steven Seagal. We have Chuck Norris. We have endless rock songs about doing heroin or cocaine or fucking and all that stuff. And has Bill O'Reilly ever once in his life come out and said, look at all the crime being committed by these frat boys on these campuses. It's got to be the culture. It's got to be the music they listen to and the entertainment and stuff like that. That's why culture is the problem. No, he wouldn't make that argument. You want to know why? Because it's a silly argument. It's a silly argument for white people. Silly argument for black people. You have the rap music and the bad culture and this and that. I got news for you, Bill. That's just entertainment. In the same way that, violent video games. I've played Rainbow Six. I still, to this day, sometimes play Nazi zombies on Call of Duty. When I'm done playing, I don't want to go pick up a gun and shoot people in the face. I'm able to make the distinction. So when you talk about entertainment for the black community, all of a sudden he takes agency out of the picture, and he pretends like they can't tell the difference, and they go, oh, just the fault of the corrosive culture and the breakdown of the family. And notice what the end result is. He ends up really avoiding discussing the real issues that would fix the problem. So when you talk about how to fix these social ills, well, the liberals have been saying it for the longest time. If you, for example, stop doing these stupid free trade deals, get out of the ones that we're in, bring good factory jobs, manufacturing jobs back here to give people an opportunity, that helps. If you have a better education system, that helps. If you raise the minimum wage and increase unionization, that helps to give people a better shot at equal opportunity. And if you, which is the biggest point here, stop the drug war, that will stop mass incarceration. I mean, the era of mass incarceration is directly tied to, and it's directly because of the drug war. Because we decided we're going to lock people up for smoking weed or selling a small amount of drugs, and it ruins their life. And it makes it so that we have more people in jail here now than fucking Stalin did in his gulags at their height. So that's the answer. The answer is everything the liberals have been talking about for decades. Let's have good, equal opportunity, a better education system, unionization, factory jobs that come back here, all these different things, and stop locking people up for smoking a little bit of weed. And if you do those things, you know what happens? All these social ills, slowly but surely, go away. But see, Bill O'Reilly, what it comes down to, guys, and this is the most important part, all he wants to do is just blame black people. Now, he doesn't say, hey, they're doing this because they're black, but he implies it. He implies it heavily. He tries to say, oh, it's a personal responsibility, corrosive culture, you know how they are. They just got to get their shit together. As opposed to saying, hey, let's be smart about this. Let's look at the macroeconomic picture. Let's look at the societal and sociological picture. And then see if we can, fix things that would then foster success naturally out of the fixed system. But he doesn't want to talk about the system. He doesn't want to talk about doing the things that would actually lead to success. He just wants to point the finger and blame black people. Okay. All right, let's go to Michael Savage here. Conservative radio host Michael Savage went on an ironic anti-revolution rant and anti-Bernie rant. Let's listen.
So as you see, my friends, I'm not so wrong when I say revolution comes to America. It's coming from Sanders and Clinton. It's coming from the Catholic Church. But it's not coming from Michael Savage. We are going to stop this revolution. We are going to save America together. We are not going to sit here passively wringing our hands. And if the time comes, I'm going to make a commitment to you right now. We will be in the streets and we will stop them. Did you hear what I just said? I will not die on this earth and leave this country in ruins for my granddaughter to inherit a wreckage because you were too cowardly to stand up for what you believe. All of you, listen to me very carefully. You may think that you can just listen to radio or read a newspaper or read a blog and stop this. You are wrong. You're going to have to put yourself out there. You're going to have to do what they're doing in Europe to stand up to these communists, or you're not going to have a nation. And if you think you're immune because you're not a rich person, you're crazy. Because first they came for the rich, but you were not rich, and you did not stand up for the rich. And then they came for the middle class, but you didn't stand up for the middle class because you were not even of the middle class. And then when they started to come for the poor, there was no one left to stand up for you because everyone else had been taken out. Do you understand how this works? The communists eat their own. They start to kill each other. They take everything from everyone, and they produce nothing. That's Bernie Sanders in a nutshell.
What a jackass this guy is. He's not coming with pitchforks and guns to get the rich. He's coming with legislation and courtrooms. And he's just trying to uphold the laws that are already on the books. But Wall Street bought influence in the government, so they have a business model that is fraud, as Bernie says all the time, and they get to get away with it. If you commit fraud, your punk ass is going to jail. You better believe it. Somebody on Wall Street commits fraud. If somebody from Goldman Sachs commits fraud, that's called a Tuesday. No, I've described it before, but we know the details of how they committed fraud. What they would do is they would take these subprime mortgage packages, they would sell it to unsuspecting clients of theirs and tell them they're going to make a lot of money if they just invest in these subprime mortgage packages. Then they would turn around and bet on those same packages to fail. So they sell a product as if it's good, they say it's good, then they bet for it to fail behind the person's back. That's fraud. You're selling something that you're pretending is good, but you know it's not good, and you're making money two ways on it. There's no other term for that except fraud. And now Bernie Sanders wants to implement the law, and your ass is mad at him? No. What a useful idiot for Wall Street and the rich this guy is. And look at, oh my God, with all the drama, please spare me. Bernie doesn't even want a revolution. He wants a political revolution, as he said time and time again. Now, for people who actually follow the issues and care about substance, they know what that means when he says that. He's talking about getting money out of politics. He's talking about actually having a government that represents the people much more than it does. That's what he's talking about. He's not talking about a revolution. But you know who is talking about that? You are, Michael Savage. That's why this whole rant was so ironic. And then we're going to go out in the streets and we're going to stop them. Yeah, I said it. Okay, so you want to go out in the streets, you want to stop them, you want to, hey, do what they're doing in Europe. That's a wink and a nod to the far-right rise in Europe. So again, it's so funny, he's like, the revolution, we must stop it. No, it sounds to me like you're not trying to stop it, you're trying to do it. So if we have a natural, democratic, organic uprising to actually enforce the laws and fix the system, and you say, no, I'm going to go out in the street and stop you, that would be you committing a revolution. And I know, he can't help himself. The poor rich, oh no, first they came for the rich, and I didn't say anything. Okay, Bernie Sanders does not plan on arresting professional athletes, arresting your doctor, arresting small business owners who might rake in $800,000 a year. The dude is not anti-rich. What he's saying is, let's enforce the laws we have, let's fix the system, let's make people pay their fair share, and let's make the system more democratic. So when you're crying about the rich and how oppressed they are and how there's class warfare going on, no, it's actually the exact opposite. There was a recent study that came out from Oxfam which found that the richest 62 people on the planet now have more wealth than the bottom 3.7 billion. 62 people have more than half the fucking world. Okay, the class warfare is already happening. It already happened. And it was waged by the rich on the middle class and the poor. And now when somebody like Bernie comes along to try to help fix it and move it in the right direction, this idiot's like, no, you have to allow them to rob us and steal from us and rig the system and fuck us in every imaginable way. It's only the right thing to do. Okay. That was fun. Always have fun ripping this guy because he's so stupid. One more, then we'll take a break. And this one is very, very upsetting. We have a hideous terror attack that just happened in Nigeria. They've been under siege recently from Boko Haram jihadists. Reuters reports, quote, two female suicide bombers killed more than 60 people at a camp for people displaced by Boko Haram in the northeast Nigerian town of Dikwa. 78 people were injured on top of that. Boko Haram has recently increased the frequency and deadliness of attacks, with three at the end of January. At least 65 people were killed outside Borno State capital Maiduguri on January 31st. Since it lost territory to a government counteroffensive last year, Boko Haram has reverted to hit-and-run attacks on villages and suicide bombings at places of worship or markets. So Vice actually did a story on this recently about how Boko Haram is now taking female sex slaves and then, in many cases, forcing them to do the terror attacks. And like they alluded to here, sometimes they do it with children as well. They'll have a child slave, and then they'll force the child to go do a terror attack. I don't think it gets any lower than this. I don't think it gets any more loathsome. I think these guys are on par with Nazis. I mean, this is basically what we're talking about here. And there's been, like we just said, there's been a war against Boko Haram from Nigerian forces that has been largely successful in many respects, in the sense that they lost more land, and they kind of feel cornered, and they're lashing out, and I guess what you could call attempted revenge attacks or whatever it may be. But make no mistake about it, man, it's clear there are good guys and there are bad guys in this situation, and we know exactly who the bad guys are. And then I also want to add this point too. This is something that I haven't heard many other people talk about before. But usually when we talk about jihadists, we're talking about just flat-out true believers, just literalists, fundamentalists to the letter. They think they are, and they're brainwashed, and they're acting out on it and stuff. Hey, Boko Haram, if you really believe, why are you sending women and children to do it? Hey, we've spoken about it. I've gone on endless rants. We did a story about ISIS in Afghanistan, where there was a guy who he was talking about what his goal is and why he's a jihadist and this and that. And there was a jihadist school where somebody's teaching. And, oh, make no mistake about it, those motherfuckers believed deeply. They were literalists. They're Quran all day long, okay? And they were like, I want to be a martyr. I want to go blow myself up. I can't wait. Because they really think, oh, my God, I'm going to get the 72 virgins, and it's going to be so great. But for Boko Haram, they're like, oh, yes, we believe so deeply. Let me tell you, and they pledge allegiance to ISIS, by the way. We believe so deeply that we're gonna go ahead and send our slaves to the suicide bombing because, you know, me, Tuesday at 8, I got stuff I got to do, bro. I don't know about you guys, but look at these guys. You don't even have the fucking courage of your convictions. You don't even have the courage of your convictions. You would rather send innocent people to go kill other innocent people than you yourself do it. These guys are the worst guys on the planet, and as is often the case, there's probably some sort of mix going on between legitimate and deep belief and literalism, and they're just flat-out jihadists, and then also simple, power-hungry, twisted, grotesque, disgusting souls who are probably trying to gain a foothold where they get some sort of legitimacy as a state-type entity, just like ISIS is trying to do at the moment. And it's more of a power struggle where, by any means necessary, they'll do it, except themselves. You know, hey, I really believe, man, but send the woman to go to the suicide bombing. Not me. Okay. All right, I do kind of have time for one more here. I guess I could do one more. Yes, I will. How about that? And we go to Yemen.
There's an incredible report coming out of Yemen detailing the struggle of hospitals there and how they've become targeted by Saudi Arabia in a relentless bombing campaign. So Huffington Post reports here, the nine-month war in Yemen has left more than 5,000 people dead and some 27,500 people injured. More than half of the dead are civilians, might I add. They continue, more than 99 health facilities, including hospitals and clinics, have been damaged or destroyed, according to the World Health Organization. Okay, let's pause here for a second. 99 health facilities have been damaged or destroyed. So these are the ones that were attacked, some of them on purpose, some of them perhaps by accident, but 99 health facilities, man. Here's what's for sure. You don't accidentally hit 99 different health facilities. No way. No way. You have to be beyond naive to believe that. They say last week, bombs slammed into a tented clinic where Doctors Without Borders was treating people displaced by war in the Yemeni city of Taiz, wounding 9 people, including 2 clinic staff. The main hospital in the city was hit by rockets last month. We covered that on the show. Another Doctors Without Borders hospital in a remote mountain valley of Yemen was reduced to rubble in late October by hours of bombardment. The staff and patients managed to escape with their lives, but the last functioning hospital in the Haydn area of northern Sada'a province was destroyed. Yemen's health system is nearing complete collapse, they say. More than 600 health facilities have shut since the conflict broke out, and more than 15 million people lack access to health services. More than 500,000 children are life-threateningly malnourished. Cancer and antiretroviral medication is in short supply. In one hospital in the capital, Sana'a, cancer patients are sleeping in the parking lot as they wait for chemotherapy, and staff have converted offices into makeshift wards. Okay, guys, understand something. This was the point. This is Saudi Arabia doing collective punishment against Yemen because it wasn't that long ago that in Yemen you had Shia Houthi rebels take over the country and oust the Sunni leader. Saudi Arabia can't have that. They want the Sunni leader in place. They got no love for the Shias or the Houthis. So they're fighting back, and part and parcel of fighting back is sometimes targeting civilians. They use cluster bombs, which are illegal under international law and have a high civilian casualty rate, and they are targeting hospitals, including Doctors Without Borders hospitals. And I just told you, 500,000 children are malnourished, on the verge of death, starving. And so, again, but you're probably thinking, well, I mean, I'm sure that we're trying to do something to fix it, right? The UN is going in there and helping these people out. I mean, tell me exactly what's going on here behind the scenes. Here's what the U.S. did to affect this situation. They just sold more weapons to Saudi Arabia for them to continue this bombing campaign. You see, there are some things where the U.S. can have a quick effect to change the outcome of a situation for the better. And usually it's the case that it's when we're arming regimes that are using the weapons for out-and-out war crimes and violations of human rights. So for everybody, and there are a lot of people in my audience, for example, who don't agree with me on my broader idea of non-interventionism, and that's fine. But I would ask these people, doesn't it make sense to prioritize the things we can affect in a quicker way? So all we would have to do to fix this situation, or at least move it in a much better direction, in a much more productive direction, is just say to Saudi Arabia, that's it, you're done. We see the record of how you're using the bombs, you're attacking hospitals and schools and killing civilians and using cluster bombs, you're done. We cut you off. We cut you the fuck off, you're done. Now, is it possible they go somewhere else with my weapon? Sure. But would it be the case that we don't have blood on our hands and it's not my tax dollars subsidizing the Salafi terror state, which is massacring civilians? Yeah, that would be the case. It wouldn't be my money. It wouldn't be blood on my hands. It wouldn't be my government in my name doing this and then sitting by idly while we see that they're attacking schools and civilians and hospitals and stuff like that. No, there are many things we could do to fix the humanitarian situation overnight. There's a great old quote. I think it was Chomsky who said it. There's an easy way to stop terrorism, stop participating in it. So if you just cut out the terrorism that you're responsible for or in part responsible for, well, then there would be a net drop in world terrorism quite a bit. Now, I get it. So there are plenty of places around the world that are not doing terrorism and violating human rights backed by us, and we actively oppose those regimes. But we can make the world a much better place if we just decided to stand up and say, all right, if you commit war crimes or violations of human rights with weapons that we give you, we're cutting you off. That's it. But, of course, we won't do that because we have this thing called the military-industrial complex where a lot of people get pretty fucking rich off of continuing to sell weapons to brutal, disgusting regimes. Okay. I got to take a break when we come back. We have a story that broke yesterday that's so fucked up that I didn't even believe it at first. I'll give you that one. It's on Tamir Rice. And then later on, Monster Energy, man, people are suing Monster Energy because it maybe, maybe not, allegedly may have killed people and given them serious health concerns. All right, stay right there. We'll be right back. Down today.
I'm bringing you down.
We have a story here that broke yesterday that's so beyond fucked up that I didn't even believe it at first. I had to read the headline over and over and go, no. Really? No, that can't be the case. So you guys remember Tamir Rice, I'm sure. We've covered his case in great detail. He was a 12-year-old boy who was outside playing with a toy gun, and the cop showed up and killed him in seconds. Literally seconds. So it's incredible. I'm sure you've all seen the video. It happened in the blink of an eye. Now, on the 911 call, the person actually said, be careful because it looks like this might be a toy gun. So I'm not sure it's a gun, and it might just be a toy gun. Now, you would think that that would make these officers proceed with caution, but one of them did not. And that one also had a history of psychological problems, by the way, where he broke down at a gun range one time because he was having a fight with his girlfriend or something, and he was crying at a gun range. And people were like, dude, what's going on here? And there were other examples of him kind of losing his marbles a little bit. So he shouldn't have been a cop. I mean, it seems fairly straightforward. But again, they just showed up and killed him. This guy showed up, shot him, and it was a very high-profile story. Well, what happened next is an outrage. We covered it. It's the fact that he didn't even get an indictment. The officer who killed him, not even an indictment. Now, everybody needs to understand something. When you don't get an indictment in a case like that, it's because the case was thrown. Guaranteed. Because indictments are beyond easy to get. You can almost indict anybody for anything. Because all you need to do for an indictment is just give your case. You don't need to give the defense's case where you say, well, here's what their take is, and this is why they think the guy's innocent. All you have to do is say, hey, here's why I think he's guilty, and just give a quick summation of why you think the person's guilty. So if it's even like an up-in-the-air thing, you're going to get an indictment. I got news for you. Showing up and killing a 12-year-old, at the very least, it's an up-in-the-air thing when it was a fucking toy gun and he was 12 years old, and the guy had a history of psychological issues, okay? But not even an indictment. It was absolutely outrageous. But today, it got even worse. The story got even worse. Raw Story reports, quote, the city of Cleveland not only billed Tamir Rice's... Apparently I can't speak today. Let me try this again. Quote, the city of Cleveland not only billed Tamir Rice's family for medical service fees, it went so far as to file a creditor's claim against them. City officials are charging the family $500 for emergency medical services rendered as the descendant's last dying expense under Ohio revised code. Oh, stop it. Stop it, stop it, stop it. They billed his family for the ambulance ride when he was dead. This is the state billing his family for the ambulance ride after he died. And remember, he was technically killed by the state. The police officer is the state, represents the state. It's tax dollars that pays him. It's a government institution. So the state kills you, kills your son, there's no justice, and then they bill you for the inconvenience of having to take his dead body in an ambulance away. I can't figure out why people are mad. I don't get it. Guys, this doesn't look like a justice system right now. It looks like an injustice system. And then when you bring in other cases, you begin to lose your mind. Remember the affluenza kid? So keep the Tamir Rice case in your mind and compare that to the affluenza kid. The guy who was responsible for deaths, and he got off because he argued, no, you can't lock me up. I'm a spoiled prick. That was the argument. Hey, he was raised as a spoiled brat, and he's so rich that he doesn't understand the consequences of his actions, so you got to let him off. If anything, wouldn't that lead you in the other direction? Hey, he's a spoiled brat. He doesn't understand the consequences of his actions, and he committed a crime. Right, so now we need to send a message that, hey, you're going to be responsible for your actions. No, they went the other way. Affluenza, you're off. Kids get locked up for smoking weed all the time. But this cop kills a 12-year-old who's playing with a toy gun, gets off, and then the state bills the fucking family. The guys on Wall Street crashed the economy. You know, they effectively stole billions, if not trillions of dollars from people because they were pushing these predatory loans where they got rich in the short term and then sold off the packages elsewhere, knowing the products were bullshit and duping people into getting these adjustable rate mortgages. So they tanked the economy, stole billions, if not trillions. They get to walk free. But in this case, an officer kills a 12-year-old who was playing with a toy gun within seconds, gets off, and then the family gets billed for the inconvenience of the ambulance ride to take your dead kid away. Yeah, when you hear a story like this, it's almost like you lose hope. There's nothing else to say about this other than we got to fix the system. We need police accountability. You know, it's not like there aren't ideas out there that would fix this. I mean, we floated a bunch of them in the great conversation we had with Michael Wood Jr., the retired Baltimore police officer who really spilled all the internal details of what goes on at departments like in Baltimore. And, you know, we go through Black Lives Matter. Like them or hate them, they have very specific policy proposals that would address a lot of these things, one of them being independent prosecutors. You know, perhaps if this case had an independent prosecutor and not somebody who was directly involved with the cops and works with them on a regular basis, then we have somebody in jail right now. Or at least we have a fucking trial. So we have to fix the system. It's broken right now, and there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Okay. Now, let's move along here to President Obama and a very special invite that he just got recently. So President Obama was formally invited to the Reason rally this year. The Freedom From Religion Foundation sent him a letter, and they said very simply that, hey, you're always at the National Prayer Breakfast, and you just recently visited a mosque, and all that stuff is fine. They have no problem with it whatsoever. In fact, they say that's a good thing. It's inclusive and all this stuff. But now it only makes sense to also maybe reach out to the unaffiliated. I mean, we count too, right? So here's what they said. Quote, such attention from the office of the president would demonstrate that free thinkers, atheists, agnostics, secular humanists, and rationalists are accepted citizens. As you pointed out in your first inaugural address, we are a nation of Christians and Muslims, Jews and Hindus, and non-believers. Okay, so should he do it? I'll give you an overwhelming fuck yeah, a resounding fuck yeah, because this is an issue. The issue of anti-atheist bigotry is something that's almost never brought up. And in fact, even bringing it up might make some people scoff at even the idea of it. But you need to realize that there are seven states in the U.S. where it's still on the law books that an atheist is not allowed to run for office. I mean, now, that is unconstitutional. We know it's unconstitutional. But the fact that it's still on the law books and there hasn't been a movement to maybe we should get those words off the page shows you that there's this general smug dismissal of atheists and agnostics and secularists and unaffiliated people, where the idea is like, oh, okay, yeah, whatever. Like, it doesn't count when people are against you because I don't know. I don't know what's going on in people's minds. Do they have it coming? Hey, those atheists kind of have it coming. Or, you know, I don't think there's any discrimination against you, even though on the state law books and seven states there it says you can't run for office. Just imagine if that was any other group, if it said it. Imagine if it said that women can't run. There would be such a national outcry, even though, again, that's unconstitutional at a federal level. The fact the words are still on the page at the state level, people be like, what the fuck is this? It's insanity. If it said a race, people would be like, what the fuck? But when it's atheists, it's just like, I don't know. Nobody's moving. Nobody's saying, hey, let's get rid of this. And also, when you look at polling data, atheists are one of the lowest in terms of people who can win an election. So in other words, people admit to pollsters they're willing to rule out atheists, and they'd say, I'd never vote for an atheist under any circumstance, almost more than any other group. So this is something that's just deeply ignorant. And then other polls show that people sometimes just conflate the idea of atheism with immorality. So in their mind, if you tell them, hey, I'm an atheist or I'm a non-believer, they think like, oh, like what happened? What, like what's wrong with you? You know, or oh, so you're like, so you don't believe in right and wrong? You're immoral. Some people hear that. When you say I'm an atheist, they think you're saying I am immoral, which is crazy because the year is 2016. It's a growing movement, but there's very few advocates out there, and there's very few reassurances where, you know, the broader population is stood up to, where people say, hey, you know what, if you might want to not only be inclusive of all the various different people of the different religions and, you know, people of different backgrounds, perhaps you should also throw a bone every once in a while to the unaffiliated, who, again, are about 20% or 23% of the U.S. population. Atheists are a much lower number, but 23% unaffiliated, so not part of an organized religion, that's pretty large, and it's going to keep growing, and it would be nice to have some official recognition and a voice for the downtrodden, which is something that, you know, liberals are supposed to be about, and they should abide by that. Okay, more. I got another interesting bill. Apparently one guy's fighting in this direction for non-believers. A Democratic lawmaker in Arizona, who also happens to be a doctor, proposed a bill this week in the Arizona House of Representatives called the Patient's Right to Know Act. And the idea behind it is very simple. You're supposed to give patients all of their options about treatment that's available to them, even if their healthcare providers don't do certain treatments because of religious beliefs. So, you know, you hear that and you might think, well, doesn't that already exist? But it doesn't, and over 20% of healthcare providers in the U.S. are religiously affiliated. So they just rule out certain kinds of treatment. They just don't allow it for religious reasons in their hospitals. Which is wacky to me. I didn't even know the extent of the problem going into reading this article. So here's what American Atheist reports on this. Quote, healthcare providers who do not provide treatment options such as abortions, vasectomies, tubal ligation, sterility-causing cancer treatments, drugs to end ectopic pregnancies, contraceptives, or in vitro fertilization because of their religious directives or philosophical beliefs would be required to inform patients that the treatments are an option. The legislation does not require any healthcare provider to provide treatments they object to. Okay, so I think the bill actually should have gone further. Now, I get it, baby steps, slowly moving in the right direction here, but the fact that you don't, like, hospitals are not forced to be hospitals and they're not forced to do the right treatment all the time, that's fucking weird, man. Like, oh, since your hospital is a religious hospital, we're not going to allow certain kinds of cancer treatment that cause sterilization because we're against sterilization because of religion? No. Why should they have the option? Because of their personal beliefs. You, the client, the patient, you can't get what you want because I, representing the establishment of the hospital, my religious beliefs, I will impose them on you and say, you can't have treatment X because it's my religious beliefs. No, that seems screwed up. So I'm happy they're moving in the right direction here, where at least the doctors have to tell people what all their options are, but it should be the case that the hospitals are required to give all the different options as well. I mean, I would have thought that was already the case, but again, it's not. Which leads me to the final point on this, which is, again, a lot of people don't know. This is an issue that's off most people's radar. There are gigantic loopholes in the law for people if they're religious, where it's not equal protection under the law and equal treatment of religions, but it's special treatment for religions. And that's a problem, and we should all be against that. So, for example, in 47 states, they have religious exemptions to immunizations. So oftentimes what they say is, oh, if you want to send your kid to school, public school, you have to immunize them. Because we need, you know, herd immunization is actually what keeps us safe from these things that we have vaccines for. If you don't do it, well, then there's going to be some sort of an outbreak. So they do that, but then some people just, well, it's my religion that I'm not going to give them this vaccine and I'm not going to immunize them. And the state can't say, oh, no. They have to say, oh, okay. Isn't that crazy? And then also there are some states where, and we've covered this on the show, parents can decide to try to faith heal their kids as opposed to bringing them to a doctor, and then if the kid dies, they can get off of all charges. There was one family that did it twice. They had one of their kids got sick. They said, nope, we're going to pray because we're deep believers. The kid ended up dying because they didn't take the kid to the hospital. It was preventable. The kid could have survived. They didn't take him to the hospital, died. The judge said, okay, we're going to have to let you off. There's this loophole in the law which says you're allowed to try to faith heal. Then they try to do it with the next kid. That kid died as well. Okay, that shouldn't be allowed. For you to say, I will deny care to my child because I believe in X, Y, or Z, well, no, then you're taking away the rights of your kid. The kid should have the right to decent medical treatment without having idiot parents that want to rely on space fairies to try to cure them instead. So religion gets special treatment under the law, and at least this is a step in the right direction to try to bring sanity back to the way the system functions. Okay, and I probably have enough time for two more. Maybe I'll get lucky and squeeze in three more. Five people have filed lawsuits against Monster Energy just this month because of alleged health issues that are linked with the drink. So a Florida law firm is taking the cases. Daily Beast reports, the lawsuits allege Monster is guilty of negligence, defective design, failure to warn of risks associated with consuming the drink, and other potential violations. And the attorneys say energy drinks like Monster say they're as bad for young people as cigarettes. That's a strong statement. So what happened? Well, they go on to explain that some people died after having a lot of Monster Energy. Some people had strokes. Some people had kidney failure. Now, a direct link has not been established, so we should be perfectly clear about that. And some of the people went as far as drinking like four giant cans of this a day for like 10 years before they had any problems. So there's also, you know, an angle to this of, I mean, if you do anything that much, I'm not sure what would happen to somebody if they drank that many Cokes over that amount of time. Maybe something really bad would happen. So I don't know. There's an angle to this as well of like, well, you had too much. It doesn't justify what happens against you. And if there is a causation correlation thing going on there, it's fucked up. But it varies from person to person. Some people drank a lot of it over years. Some people just had it two or three times and then something bad happened. But there's one fact in here which is the most telling to me. They say, quote, Monster bypassed FDA regulation by billing itself as a dietary supplement rather than a food when it launched in 2002. According to lawsuits, Monster did so to avoid limits on caffeine content imposed on soft drinks and other beverages. Oh, look at what we have here. So still to this day, they have on their can, it says energy blend. So they list some of the ingredients, and for some of the ingredients, they put the amount that's in there. For caffeine, they have caffeine under energy blend, and it's bundled in with a bunch of other stuff, and they don't give you the exact amount of caffeine because the amount of caffeine is really, really fucking high. And some people are saying that they think that the problems associated with this, with some people and their health issues, is simply from a massive caffeine overdose. From having too many Monster Energies and the caffeine that's in it puts them over the edge and they have all these health problems. So, I mean, there are a few answers here. Number one, still should be legal. I think it still should be taxed. It's both of those things. But there's a third part to it, regulate it. And that leads to point number two, which is they're saying Monster bypassed FDA regulation by saying we're a dietary supplement. Now, I gave you the story in the past about how dietary supplements have no regulation associated with it whatsoever. people wrongly think, oh, the FDA looks into that. No, the dietary supplement, there's a massive loophole that the supplement companies lobbied for in, I think it was the 1990s, and they won. And so when you go to GNC or you go to Vitamin Shop, the overwhelming majority of the stuff on the shelves, there was the FDA's not looking after that, which is why studies came out recently which found that a lot of the things you're taking, the pills you're taking, the supplements you're taking, it's just like rice or soy that was put into the little gelatin caplets that you take. It ain't even really helping you, those things. There's no regulation. And they did the same thing for Monster. Just call it a dietary supplement. Then we don't have to put all this stuff and be super accurate about it. And then we get to get around this. And, hey, if some people get sick or hurt because it's got a lot of caffeine and some other shit in it, whatever. No, not whatever. Here's the deal. Again, I'm not for banning it. I'm in favor of legalizing, taxing, and regulating all drugs. But the regulation part is very important. It should be clear what's in it. It should be clear the health problems associated with it. And there should be recommended amounts and perhaps regulation as to what age you can buy it. So, hey, maybe only 14 or 16 and up you can buy it. Maybe it says the recommended amount is just one can per day, and if you do any more than that, it could be dangerous, and you put that on the label. Guys, you got to be smart about it. You can't just, have anarchy, like legalize it and just anarchy, no regulation and none of that. No, you need to legalize it, tax it, and regulate it efficiently and effectively so that at least we have full disclosure, and then if something happens where somebody gets sick, it makes much more sense to say, okay, well, you knew the risks and you chose to do that. Right now, that's not the case. They don't know the risks, and because of loopholes in the law, Monster Energy doesn't really have to tell them the risks. Okay. RT is reporting that the Saudi religious police, the morality police over there, arrested a female mascot at a candy store. Now, why did they do it? I don't know. It gets kind of weird here. Let me explain. So they say the mascot was making inappropriate gestures, and it was unacceptable. Now, in the article I read, they didn't go on to explain what those inappropriate gestures were. I can only imagine. Were they doing the suck it thing, or were they shaking their ass or something? I don't know. It's a mascot. How bad could it possibly be? They say, quote, "We found a man in the female," I think this is the police statement, "we found a man in the female mascot, and after contacting the superintendent, we spoke to the man in the doll and made him and his supervisor write a statement that they will not repeat this again." And then here's what the statement said that they were forced to write by the religious police. "We reminded them about Allah and that what they did was pretending to be women, and that is against Sharia." And they go on to say, "They expressed remorse and we asked them to accompany us to the station to complete the formalities." Okay. Let it go. Basically, you know what the morality police are, the religious police are? They're people, they're paid thugs. That's what they are. They're state-sanctioned thugs. You get to go out there, you get to harass women, you get to harass anybody who you don't like and you don't agree with and you have a grudge against, and you get to hide behind the veil of, "I'm not doing it because I'm a dick. I'm not doing it because, I'm the problem here. I'm doing it because of religion. I'm upholding the will of the almighty God here when I pester you for no fucking reason." Do me a favor. Point to me in the Quran or the Hadith where it says that mascots can't try to sell candy in front of a candy shop. Oh, you can't find it. But see, that's what they do. They try to find, oh, okay. Well, no, it's bad because Allah says a man can't pretend to be a woman, and you're by wearing this mascot thing, you're pretending to be a woman. No, he's not pretending. He's being a mascot to try to get people into the candy store. I think everybody knows he's not a woman. That's not pretending to be a woman. But furthermore, wait. So it goes without saying, I'm sure there's not a vibrant transgender community in Saudi, is there? Because you're saying right here, we don't allow it under Sharia. Fuck off. I mean, we've spoken about this in the context of the U.S. before, and I rail against conservatives here all the time because they say stupid things like, you know, very simple, God made you with the plumbing, and that's the end of the conversation. Or not. Or there's some people that genuinely have, they have male anatomy but female brains, or female anatomy but male brains, where they say, hey, look, I'm not what this suggests. So, and who the fuck are you to tell them, I disagree. Allah disagrees. No, but the thing is, there's nothing backing that up. You're just asserting it. Allah, no. God is not a response. It's a cop-out. That's what it is. So now you're going around policing fucking mascots? It's a mascot, dude. Get the fuck over it. But that's the thing. Fundamentalists, literalists, religious extremists, they're against everything before they even know what the fuck they're against. They're against fun, they're against innovation, everything has to be boring and dry, and let us control everything. And no, this is why I'm fundamentally against the right and the religious right in every country, because they're fucking goofballs, man. They're against freedom, they're against happiness, you know, and this is why, if you'll notice, it's always those people that need violence to back up their ideology. Why? Because there's no innate appeal to their ideology. People who are socially liberal, you don't need to try to sell that idea hard because it's just, hey, do what you want as long as you're not hurting anybody. People gravitate to that because they fucking like that. You don't need violence to enforce that. But these assholes who have an ideology that's not fun at all, they have to use violence to enforce it, because if they didn't, nobody would agree with it. All right, guys, I'm out of time. I love you. Enjoy the Dem debate tonight, and I'll see you tomorrow. Peace.